Chapter 20. Irene ran the sensor data back on the main display between the pilot and co-pilot seats and ran through it forward again quickly, with the four others looking over her shoulder. Thanks to Emby, they had a nearly complete view of the massive air battle that had now dissolved into desperate duels between individual aircraft. "Damn," Dave exhaled quietly. This was the third time they'd watched the replay. The first time, everyone had been talking excitedly as they watched the symbols engage in a deadly dance across the screen. The second time, Irene narrated the action from a pilot's viewpoint. The third time, they all simply sat and watched in shocked silence. Modern air combat was incredibly intense and high tempo. By MB's count, 88% of the combat aircraft on Paradise had been destroyed during the first 90 minutes of fighting. And the actual fighting had lasted perhaps 20 minutes, with the rest of the time taken by aircraft flying toward their targets, maneuvering into attack position, and flying back to their bases, if those bases still existed. Most aircraft had set down in remote areas, relying on fuel, weapons, and spare parts being brought to them. Many of the surviving aircraft were crippled in one way or another. By the end of 2 hours, neither side had an effective air combat force left.
"Now it's up to you guys." Irene looked at Dave and Jesse.
"What do you mean, ma'am?" Dave asked, confused. What did she expect him to do?
"Not you two specifically. I meant infantry," Irene explained. "Without enough air power to do anything useful, this becomes a ground war. Infantry. The Ruhar and the Kristang will have to rely on infantry."
"To do?" Jesse raced to guess what their pilot meant.
"To do what?
How do you defeat an integrated air defense system?" Perkins asked.
"You make it unintegrated," Dave answered immediately. This was easy training manual stuff. "Don't attack the whole system, that's suicide. You take it apart piece by piece."
"Precisely," Perkins nodded. "Destroy one piece of the system at the edge. A radar, a launcher, one piece. That creates a gap in the integration, a blind spot, a weakness. Take out a few more pieces and you've created a safe passage corridor for your aircraft. Once you have that, you can send in a pure strike package instead of loading up the sorties with electronic countermeasure aircraft."
"Until the enemy moves their pieces around," Irene added. "Raiders and launchers are mobile."
"They are," Perkins agreed. "But these projectors are not mobile. The Kristang know that. They don't have sufficient air power left, so they will send in ground troops to destroy a projector or take it offline or take control of it. Once they know that particular projector is inactive, they know a part of the sky is not covered, and they can send in a ship. When enough projectors are confirmed offline, the Kristang can take back control of the sky."
"Got it," Jesse said as the reality dawned on him. "It's going to be a race between the hamsters and the lizards. The Ruhar will try to defend active projector sites and bring new ones online, and the Kristang will try to destroy them or take control."
"The Ruhar should have an advantage, right?" Shauna asked. "Emby will tell them where the other projectors are, but the Kristang will have to guess."
"I need to ask Emby what we do next, because this is a whole new ballgame," Perkins said, pulling out her Z-phone to type a new message. As she typed, she looked at Jesse and Dave. "If we get involved in any ground action, I need you to, because I have no infantry experience. I handled intel for UNEF. Before that, I was in communications. I used a keyboard, not a rifle."
Ski was surprised. "Not even in basic training, ma'am?"
She shook her head ruefully. "Not a whole lot. I was commissioned in the Air Force."
"Air Force, ma'am?" Jesse asked with a quick glance at the U.S. Army insignia on her uniform. He was glad that he hadn't said anything bad about the other service in her presence.
"There was a blue-to-green initiative a while back," she explained.
The U.S. military had needed more people in the Army and Marine Corps, more boots on the ground. Personnel in the Navy and Air Force were encouraged to transfer to green uniforms, strongly encouraged.
"They let me know that if I wanted to stay in as a career, I needed to switch services."
"Oh." Jesse didn't know what else to say.
"Glad to have you with us, ma'am."
Dave also didn't know what else to say. MB's reply came swiftly. "Proceed to the attached coordinates and activate the projector there as soon as possible." It was followed by a shorter message. "Thank you. Good work."
"Yes," Skippy exulted 2 days later. "They did it. The fifth projector is now online. Joe, I will send a message of congratulations to Major Perkins and her team. Also, a message to get the hell out of there ASAP in case we need to use that projector real quick."
"Agreed. Hey, Skippy,
We can now shoot at Kristang ships with this new projector?
That was the idea, Joe. Why?
Because now I'm thinking we don't do that. Not right away.
Once again, I'm not following your logic, Joe.
What I'm thinking is that when the Kristang jump a ship in to test us,
Joe,
I must caution you that the Kristang are likely to test our projectors with more than one ship. That is standard Kristang fleet doctrine when attacking a planet equipped with ground-based defenses.
That won't make any difference to what I want to do. In fact, that's even better. We let the Kristang get comfortable in orbit. They will at first stick to areas not covered by the four projectors they know about. When they think we only have those four projectors active, the first thing they will do is try hitting those projectors with a railgun strike, right?
That is sound tactics, yes. The projectors do have shields, although two of the projectors have very little power left for either shields or the maser.
Got it. Here's what we do, depending where the ships jump in.
Team, MB says we need to haul ass out of here pronto, Perkins declared. I think the Kristang are sure to come back to test whether we have more than those four projectors active. She didn't know two of those projectors were nearly depleted. If MB has to shoot soon, we don't want to be anywhere near this thing.
Do we have a new target, ma'am?
Irene asked wearily. After parking her buzzard, she had helped the team set up the drill and punch down to the projector's control chamber. It had been Jesse's turn to go down the hole. The holes were now larger in diameter, but Irene still shook when she thought about it. Mercifully, Major Perkins had declared they could not risk their only pilot, so Irene was relieved of having to slide down into the ground again.
Yeah, of course, Perkins's voice reflected her own weariness.
After the frantic scramble to get the first four projectors activated, they had all been dead tired. Then, MB had acted early for some reason and blasted the Kristang battle group from the sky. That had given the team a shot of energy they used to get the fifth projector dug out and online. Now, they were all running on empty.
Another projector. We'll need to go back to the truck to refuel first. Let's get moving, people.
Tired fingers fumbled and tired legs wobbled, but the task of breaking down the drill rig and tying it back in the sling was well known to them by now. By the time Irene came back with the buzzard and Shauna lowered the cable, the sling was ready. Major Perkins was swaying on her feet, fighting creeping sleepiness. They needed a break. According to MB, they couldn't afford to stop now. Regardless of MB's instructions, she was going to give the team 8 full hours of sleep after they got back to the truck and the buzzard was refueled. The pilot absolutely had to rest, and while Irene was sleeping, the rest of the team could get rest also. Paradise was going to have to get along without them for a few hours.
We didn't have to wait long for the Kristang to test whether the four projectors we'd used in our sneak attack were all we had.
They're here, Skippy announced.
A mere 2.5 hours after Perkins and the crew got the fifth projector working and cleared out of the area, 3 Kristang destroyers jumped in above the far side of the planet. Knowing the weak shields of their frigates did not stand a chance against our projectors, the Kristang had wisely left their little ships out of this action. The Kristang commander wasn't stupid. At first, he kept his ships out of the targeting cones of the 4 projectors that he knew about. When his ships were not hit, he must have figured we only had 4 projectors, which is exactly what I wanted the lizards to think. Next, he had to test the 4 known projectors to see if they were still active. After his surviving ships had jumped away, they must have examined all the sensor data from our sneak attack and realized that the last shots of 2 particular projectors were at a much lower power level. Logically, they correctly concluded that those projectors were almost drained of power, so they really only needed to worry about 2 of the known projectors.
They're lining up railgun shots on the projectors, Skippy warned. Even with 5 projectors, I can't hit those ships where they are now. They're going to fire railguns at an extremely shallow angle to keep the ships out of our targeting cones. That will decrease the impact of the railgun darts because they will be traveling through more of the atmosphere.
Do your thing, Skippy. 2 of the destroyers fired their railguns at our 2 healthy projectors. They knew those 2 projectors couldn't hit the ships from where they were, and they also knew the other 2 projectors didn't have enough power to penetrate a destroyer's shields. What they didn't know about was the incredible awesomeness of Skippy the Magnificent. As the railgun darts streaked in at 22% of light speed, they passed through the targeting cone of a mostly depleted projector. That projector couldn't harm a shielded starship, but its maser did have enough power to deflect the darts from their targets and break the darts into bite-sized pieces. By itself, a projector couldn't have hit a speeding dart, but our projectors were controlled by Skippy, so hitting 2 objects traveling at almost 1/4 of light speed was not a problem.
He simply fired the maser ahead of the ballistic flight path of a dart and let the dart fly into it.
Oh my God, those freaking darts were slow as molasses in January, Skippy complained, using an expression I hadn't heard since my grandmother said it.
Did the Kristang actually use a railgun, or did they just toss those darts out a window? I got so bored waiting for them that I did 100 crossword puzzles. Anyway, it worked.
The dart pieces impacted the surface around the projectors and threw up two enormous clouds of dust and debris, but only one piece the size of a fingernail did hit a projector. That piece was easily deflected by the projector's shield, leaving the maser cannon unharmed. And the Kristang, whose crappy senses entirely missed our maser firing, saw two plumes of dust surrounding the two healthy projectors and concluded their strike had been successful. They congratulated themselves on knocking out two multi-terawatt projectors, bragging on ship-to-ship transmissions about how badass they were. Skippy almost puked listening to them.
Oh yeah, you're badasses, all right. Give me a minute and we'll salute you great warriors properly.
Skippy's idea of a salute came in the form of maser beams. With the Kristang semi-confident there were no active projectors on the surface, they sent one, then all three destroyers into the targeting cones. Each destroyer, brave but not stupid, would only briefly flit through the targeting cone. That was all Skippy needed. As soon as there were two destroyers within range at the same time, he told me to press the big red button on my Z-phone to fire the weapons. Two destroyers against three projectors. Two of those projectors had only one shot each left, and the shields of a Kristang destroyer could deflect the full power of a projector long enough for the ship to perform an emergency jump away. The odds were not in our favor. Skippy, of course, didn't see any point in playing fair. Both of the projectors the Kristang thought they had knocked out fired 2 milliseconds apart. Each of those projectors fired at a different ship, and by themselves they could not have penetrated a destroyer's shields. Our secret fifth projector also fired, first at one ship and then at the second, each shot 2 milliseconds apart, so that each ship was struck by the full power of two projectors at once. The combined maser power punched right through the destroyer's shields. The ship's hulls were armored, made of layers of tough ceramic composites and heat-dissipating foam. If the maser beams had a sense of humor, they would have laughed at the Kristang ship designers' attempt to protect their vessels. The maser beams cut through the hulls as if they were tissue paper, slicing the ships apart. Thick, armored interior bulkheads melted under the intense heat, exploding and becoming projectiles inside their own ships. Power conduits ruptured, and missiles spontaneously exploded in their launch tubes, turning the ships into spinning hulks. The lucky third destroyer immediately jumped away.
Hey, where did you go, asswipe? Skippy shouted.
You want some of this? You want some of this?
Say hello to my little friend, Mr. Maserbeam.
I got plenty more where that came from, you punk-ass bitch.
Damn, Skippy, chill out. You got them already, I said, as on the display, one of the stricken destroyers blew apart when its missile magazine cooked off.
I do not like lizards, Joe. I do not like bullies.
Big red button again, Joe.
Sure, I said, as I held the button down.
Why?
One of those ships is annoyingly lucky. It hasn't blown up yet. One of our original four projectors only has a weak shot left, but watch what happens when even a weak maser hits an unshielded ship's reactor.
On the display I was watching, a light flared where a crippled destroyer had been.
Oops, Skippy chuckled. My bad. Sorry about that.
Darn, I hate it when that happens.
Well, I'm sure the Kristang will forgive and forget. Or not. Whatever.
I'm thinking not, Skippy.
Hey, that was great.
I accepted a high five from Sergeant Adams.
Keep monitoring their communications, please. I want to know if the Kristang plan to test our defenses again.
Unlikely, Joe. The Kristang commander is right now screaming at his remaining ships to stay away from the planet until his ground forces can degrade our air defense capability. There was supposed to be a follow-on attack by the other Kristang ships, but that has now been postponed indefinitely.
Huh. I wonder why, I asked with a smile.
Maybe they didn't sell enough tickets, Joe?
How much longer should we wait, Commodore?
Commodore Ferlant answered his executive officer's question without turning his attention away from the tactical display. If Ferlant were an admiral, the Rue Gustalo would have a captain, and Ferlant would have to concern himself only with commanding his task force. Because he was not an admiral, he needed to also act as the ship's captain.
Because he didn't have time to act as captain in the middle of a running battle, most of the responsibility for ship handling fell to his executive officer, Tom Smith.
"We will wait until the Dulandu has a full charge," Ferlant announced.
The frigate Sas Dulandu had accompanied Ferlant's cruiser on every jump after the projectors had thrown the situation around Gitanu into absolute chaos. Since Ferlant's initial order for his small task force to scatter, his ships had been hounded by the still much larger force of remaining Kristang ships. Every time one of his ships jumped, the enemy attempted to pursue, analyzing the residual signature of the Ruhar ship's outbound wormholes to determine where they had jumped to. Each time one of his ships jumped, they dropped off quantum resonators behind them to confuse enemy sensors and conceal the jump wormhole signature. The resonators were partially effective, as it usually took the Kristang almost an hour to determine where the Ruhar had gone. But after 39 hours of unrelenting pursuit, Ferlant's ships were running low on quantum resonators, and his ships' jump drives were badly in need of a rest to recalibrate their coils. They would likely get no such rest. Each time the Ruhar ships jumped with misaligned coils, their messy jump created a louder signature, and the quantum resonators became less and less effective at concealing where the ship had jumped to. Eventually, Ferlant knew the Kristang would wear his ships down. The Kristang had several significant advantages in the pursuit. They still had more ships, so they could send several ships on pursuit while the others stood down for maintenance, and they could concentrate on killing Ferlant's ships one at a time, while merely keeping his other ships moving so they couldn't effectively support each other.
"Commodore," Smith said quietly, "this can't continue forever."
They were waiting for the Sas Dulandu to complete charging her jump coils, because that frigate's coils were overheating due to overuse. Soon, individual coils would begin to burn out, throwing that ship's entire jump drive system so badly out of alignment that it would be unable to sustain a jump wormhole.
"I know," Ferlant answered quietly.
So far, he had not lost a single ship, although the destroyer City of Falenton had been badly damaged in an attack. The Lenten was able to jump, but not able to do much else. Her stealth field and defensive shields were inoperable. Ferlant had assigned the City of McMurrow to accompany her stricken sister ship, but the Lenten might need to be abandoned, and her crew transferred to the McMurrow. He was losing the fight. It had become a battle of attrition, and his ships were wearing out faster than the Kristang ships were falling apart.
"When the Dulandu is ready, we are jumping outside the system. Three jumps, maximum range."
"We're abandoning Gitanu?" Smith asked.
He agreed with the Commodore's decision. He also wanted to understand it.
"We are effecting a temporary strategic retreat in order to regroup and regain the initiative," Ferlant explained in proper military terms.
Someday, high-ranking fleet officials would review the bridge data recorder during the action to determine whether Commodore Ferlant's decisions had been appropriate. Hopefully, Ferlant would be alive then to explain himself.
"Our ships need an opportunity to go offline and effect repairs."
Smith agreed.
"If the Kristang will leave us alone long enough."
"I am cautiously optimistic that once he knows we have left the system, Admiral Kekrondo will turn his attention back to reestablishing his control of the space around Gitanu."
"And after our repairs are complete?" Smith asked.
"Then we regain the initiative," Ferlant said with a tight smile.
"Sir?"
"The hunters will become the hunted."
"I can walk," Celie assured Derek. Her legs were not as assuring. She could not, in fact, walk.
"It doesn't look like it," Derek said gently. "My right leg is fine," she insisted.
Her left leg was broken in two places, somewhere along her way crashing down through the trees. She also had internal injuries from whatever piece of the exploding Dobra had hit her after they ejected. When Derek found Celie, she had been unconscious, tangled in parachute cords, hanging upside down. Working carefully with his injured shoulder, Derek had cut away cords and parachute fabric to make a rope and slowly lowered her to the ground. Peeling away her blood-soaked flight suit, he found an ugly, bloody wound on her left side. Whatever magical nanobots swam in her blood had done their best to stitch the wound closed, but she had already lost a lot of blood, based on the amount that had soaked her flight suit and dripped onto the forest floor. In her flight kit, Derek had found bandages, emergency rations, and four vials of injectable medical supplements. He couldn't read all of the complicated Ruhar technical terms,
so he used his Z-Phone's camera to translate for him. The vials contained additional nanobots, vitamins and minerals, and whatever types of sugars and proteins the Ruhar used as food.
Do we have a choice?
No, Derek agreed. While his Z-Phone wasn't working, Saley had been able to exchange brief, encrypted messages with the Ruhar military guard system. She had sent a distress call, stating her injuries, location, and that she was with a human co-pilot. She urgently needed medical care. Derek was also injured, and Derek did not have any source of food. The reply was not encouraging. Air rescue was out of the question. The horrific air battle had wiped out most of the Ruhar's combat aircraft. The few aircraft that remained were being reserved to defend vital infrastructure or to conduct strikes against the Kristang. Risking a precious aircraft with 5 crew members to rescue 1 downed pilot was not an option at that time. Saley was advised to walk her way out. There was a road several days away. If she could get near the road, Ruhar Command would see if any of the civilians in the area would be willing to drive out to pick her up. Basically, the reply stated that there was a war on and they didn't have any aircraft to spare. The reply also wished her good luck. Ruhar Command didn't say anything about Derek, other than to question why a human had been with Saley in the first place. They had no suggestion what he should do about the lack of food.
If you can stand, you can lean on my shoulder, Derek suggested. Let's try that.
Holding onto a tree, Saley managed to stand on 1 wobbly leg. Derek got her arm draped over his shoulder and they practiced stumbling through the forest.
Easy enough, Derek concluded. This is like a 3-legged race.
What? Saley asked, confused. Derek shook his head. That reference hadn't translated into Ruhar as he intended.
It's a human custom, something we do at picnics. Forget it, let's save our energy.
With his free hand, he checked the map on his Z-Phone. Getting to the road was not going to be easy. There were hills to climb and streams to cross. As they walked, Saley would grow weaker from her unhealed injuries, and Derek would grow weaker from hunger.
One step at a time. Here we go.
Admiral, the Vikran reports that the entire enemy force has jumped outside the system, the captain of the Kedwala stated.
The destroyer, we are proud to honor Clan Subleader Belden Ush Vikran, who inspires us every day, was a brothership of the We Are Proud to Follow the Shining Example of Combat Rifleman Tutwas Val Kedwala. But while the Kedwala had the dubious honor of hosting the Admiral, the Vikran had been off having fun and seeking glory chasing the Ruhar Task Force. With the Admiral's normal command ship, the battlecruiser He Who Pushes Aside Fear Shall Always Be Victorious, having been obliterated by a projector above Perdassus, the Kedwala had become the battlegroup's command ship by default. Neither the Admiral nor the crew of the Kedwala were happy about this situation, but whereas Admiral Kikrondo was free to express his dissatisfaction loudly and frequently, the crew of the Kedwala had to at least pretend they were honored to host the battlegroup commander. Because to openly state their fervent desire to stuff the Admiral and his staff into an airlock and blow them into space would not be a good career move. Although that was a totally understandable sentiment.
Confirmed. The enemy has now performed 3 consecutive jumps beyond the system limits and might be preparing to jump again. The Vikran requests instructions.
Technically, the captain of the Vikran himself was not requesting instructions. The Vikran had been sent back to the Kedwala by Senior Captain Gurkaw in command of the pursuit squadron. That senior captain had requested instructions, and he had not so much requested instructions as hoped that the standing instructions he already had would be changed. Admiral Kikrondo had ordered the pursuit squadron to halt pursuit if the enemy passed a certain distance from the Perdassus system, and the pursuit squadron had already gone beyond that imaginary line. The senior captain hoped the admiral would ignore that minor violation and give permission to continue the pursuit. The enemy's ships were worn down, the senior captain's message said excitedly. Another couple jumps, surely a dozen at most, and the pursuit squadron would have the Ruhar trapped. Kikrondo read the message with displeasure. Most of his demanding job, he thought angrily, was reining in overly aggressive commanders who were eager to do stupid, rash things that risked losing the considerable advantage his battlegroup still possessed. The fact that frequent use of overly aggressive, rash actions were how he had become promoted to the Admiralty did not cross Kikrondo's mind. The battlegroup was his command now, and if anyone was going to do something recklessly stupid, it was going to happen on Kikrondo's orders. Not on the initiative of glory and promotion-seeking Senior Captain Gurkaw. With Admiral Kikrondo having lost most of his combat power to a sneak attack by previously unknown projectors, he knew his position in command was precarious. If the clan leadership was looking to replace Kikrondo, a senior captain in command of a successful pursuit squadron would be a convenient candidate.
"Inform Senior Captain Gurkaw that he is to adhere to my standing instructions," Kikrondo said firmly. "He is not to run off and risk my ships in his personal desire for glory."
19 hours had passed, and there was no sign of continued pursuit by the Kristang. Cautiously, Commodore Ferlant allowed two ships at a time to take critical systems offline for much-needed maintenance. His cruiser Rugastalo would remain on full alert to protect the vulnerable ships undergoing repairs. Only after all the other ships in the little task force had been brought to full combat readiness would the Gastalo herself begin heavy maintenance. As Ferlant had risen through the ranks to captain and now temporary commodore, he had come to rely more and more on a quote from one of his instructors way back at the military academy. She had told the class that amateurs discuss tactics, professionals discuss logistics. Ferlant had not been surprised to learn that even the humans had a similar saying on their primitive home world. Tactics, Ferlant considered as he reviewed ship status reports, were useless without the means to implement them. The ships under his command were warships only if they were capable of performing near their designed capability, and to accomplish that required constant attention to tasks that were painstaking and mundane. Combat action, even an action of continually running from enemy pursuit, wore down critical systems. Without a pause to rest, repair, and replace vital components, his warships would become nothing more than composite tubes which held air only so long as the enemy held off attack. Despite constant demands from the government on Gitanu for his ships to come back, Ferlant was not going to be hasty and stupid. He was going to take a pause from the battle in order to bring all of his ships back up to full fighting condition. All of his ships, that is, except for the destroyer City of Falenton. That ship had been badly damaged in a Kristang attack. It had barely escaped from a damping field while providing cover to give the frigate Sastalandu time to jump away. A destroyer risking itself to protect a much less valuable frigate was a questionable tactic, but Ferlant had not criticized the Lenten's captain. Ferlant would have done the same thing had he been in command of the destroyer. The Lenten was too heavily damaged to be brought back up to full combat capability, so Ferlant instructed that ship's crew to perform only cosmetic repairs and basic maintenance on the jump drive and defensive shields. Ferlant had a special task in mind for the Lenten. One last task. Eric Koblenz had gone from elation to severe depression to cautious hopefulness to confused disappointment in the space of a week, and now he was merely numb. When the Kristang battle group arrived in orbit and chased the Ruhar ships away, the Keeper faction and UNEF had been triumphant, certain that life for UNEF would now return to normal, that those humans who had been disloyal to the Kristang would be punished, and that loyal Keepers would soon return to Earth, having accomplished their mission for the Kristang. Eric experienced a joyous few days, warning disloyal non-keepers that their fate was sealed, certain that his loyalty would be rewarded. Keeper leaders attempted to contact the Kristang in the days immediately following arrival of the battle group, but they were rebuffed. Then came a scathing message from the Kristang that was a stinging rebuke. All humans had in some way cooperated with the Ruhar, if only by growing their own food, and therefore removing a logistics burden from the enemy Ruhar. Those who called themselves Keepers were equally traitorous. The Kristang valued action, not words, and the Keepers had not done anything against the Ruhar. Also, the Kristang no longer had access to Earth, so no humans would be going home. The Kristang were not impressed by the actions of some Keepers to destroy tractors and other equipment the Ruhar provided, equipment the Ruhar had already remotely disabled. Eric didn't know what to do or think. What was the point of remaining loyal to an alien species that considered him to be a traitor? His government on Earth had allied with the Kristang. Now that government on humanity's homeworld had no effective authority over the people isolated on an alien world. He had no good options. No hope.
"Major Perkins, ma'am," Irene called her current commanding officer into the buzzard's cockpit. "I just picked up a distress call about the downed Ruhar pilot. She's injured, and not far from here."
Perkins frowned.
As a pilot, Strebitch might feel a call to rescue any and all of her fellow aviators in distress. Perkins couldn't allow her team to be distracted from their mission.
I'm sure there are many pilots down after that air battle. Yes, ma'am, but this Ruhar pilot has a human with her.
What?
How did that happen?
How, I don't know, ma'am, Irene admitted. The distress call is from the human, a Lieutenant Derek Bonsu. He was the co-pilot or weapons system officer in a chicken when the battle started. I guess they got caught up in the furball. He tried to get air rescue from the Ruhar, but they have few aircraft left, and they are unable to assist at this time.
They've been down since the day of the air battle?
Yes, ma'am. The Ruhar is in a bad way. She's injured and still losing blood. This Lieutenant Bonsu doesn't have any food.
Irene pointed at the map on the display.
Even by himself, it would take him a couple more days to walk to the nearest Ruhar settlement, and they wouldn't have any human food there. He says his pilot won't last that long anyway. This area, her finger circled the map, is remote. No roads and few settlements. They need air rescue.
Shit.
Damn it.
It can be done, ma'am, Irene assured Perkins. We can lure a crewman to hook them up to a cable.
Lieutenant, I meant damn it as in, of course, we do have to assist. We are not leaving a human out there to starve.
Irene couldn't keep a smile off her face.
It will only be a 40-minute flight, ma'am, going low and slow.
Don't start the engines yet, Strebic. First, I'm going to contact MB and see if they can do anything to help them without us.
If not, ma'am, then I'm going to ask MB what the mission security fallout will be of us bringing a Ruhar aboard.
And we'll need to fly this Ruhar someplace where she can get medical care. That will seriously blow our cover.
We could retrieve only Lieutenant Bonsu, Irene said with a frown.
Major Perkins snorted.
Strebic, you're a pilot. Would you leave one of your aircrew behind?
No, she answered without hesitation.
I expect this Lieutenant Bonsu feels the same way about his pilot.
She sighed and pulled out her Z-phone to type a message.
At times like this, I wish MB would answer a simple damned phone call instead of me typing everything.
Crap, Skippy, I said when we got the message from Perkins. Does Perkins have to pick this guy up? That road isn't far. At least it didn't appear very far on the map. I wasn't on the ground walking on an empty stomach. If I can get there, he can follow the road to this village here. I pointed to a dot on the map.
That expression never made any sense to me, Joe. How do you follow a road? Roads are static. They never move. If you said, follow a car on the road, then I would understand. Maybe the expression should be, remain on the road. Although if you say road, it is kind of implied that you stay on it, unless the instructions...
Skippy.
What?
Focus. Please try to focus.
Forget what I said. If this guy thinks he can't make it to the road, I'm not going to sit here and second-guess him. Especially since I could smell the lasagna that Adams was heating up for dinner, and Bonsu hadn't eaten for days. A downed human pilot. I should have thought of this.
There are an infinite number of things you should have thought of and didn't, Joe, Skippy replied. Like, you have bread and peanut butter but no fluff, therefore no fluffernutter for you.
This is a little more important, Skippy. Although after he said it, I was craving the sweet and salty deliciousness of a fluffernutter.
I'll need to call Chotek about this. Is there anything you can do to help those pilots, instead of Perkins rescuing them?
Not that I can see, Joe. The air assets of both the Ruhar and Kristang are severely depleted, and Lieutenant Bonsu is in sort of a no-man's land between the two forces.
Oh, boy. This isn't going to be good. We need to plan for Perkins' cover to be blown for the remainder of her mission.
Why, Joe? We could just order her to continue the mission and forget Lieutenant Bonsu.
Skippy, I said wryly. I don't want to become a damn pogue. You forget that before I got this cushy day job, I was a soldier in the field. Perkins asking permission to rescue those two pilots was more of an FYI. She's going, unless we have a better idea.
Oh, okay, Joe. I couldn't imagine you leaving Bonsu out there to starve anyway.
You got that right. I picked up my Z-phone to call the Flying Dutchman. What the hell was I going to say to Chotek?
Hey, Skippy. Perkins blowing her cover doesn't involve any risk of our cover being blown, does it?
The shiny little beer can chuckled.
No way, dude. I've got our tracks totally covered. Do what you gotta do. I've got your back.
I appreciate that, Skippy.
Flying Dutchman? This is Colonel Joe Bishop. I need to speak with Mr. Chotek, please.